Okay, thank you for joining us. This is Craig Lubo, and my guest today is Cynthia Levin. She is the artistic director at the Unicorn Theater in Kansas City, Missouri. And she has been there since 1979. This is her 39th year. It's the 44th season coming up for the Unicorn. And welcome, Cynthia.
Hi, thanks for having me, Craig.
Okay. I want to start, before we start talking about what's coming up in the upcoming season, and I gave you a heads up a couple weeks ago.
Uh-oh. What?
The National Endowment for the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
A particular, I won't mention them, but a particular political party wants to eliminate it.
Yeah.
And the president wants to eliminate
right.
it.
Right.
What would that mean for theaters like the Unicorn and other theaters of that type?
Well, you know, this isn't the first time this has come up. I recall, in the 90s, this also reared its ugly little head about abolishing the NEA or the censorship rules or, you know, the any way that you can try to make it a smaller and smaller number of people that could possibly apply for funding. It's going to hurt. I mean, anything that you take away from arts funding at this point is going to really, really hurt all of us, because there's so very little arts funding on a government level, on a national level, on a local level. I mean, it's all up to individuals now to try to keep everybody alive. So absolutely, it would hurt us. We'd have to find either cut certain things or find other ways to fund certain, you know, important programs, and we're not alone in that. You know, I would say probably 75% of the theaters across the country are funded in part by the NEA, and also the money trickles down from the NEA to state supported, you know, programs. So it's not just the individual theaters, it's all of the, it is individual theaters, but a lot of that money goes out to rural areas and education and, you know, just, it would be a terrible, terrible thing to cut any sort of large funding for the arts on a national level.
So there would be more than just theaters that would be affected?
Well, it's all performing arts, you know, and it is education when you talk about the NEH, you know, and so any sort of funding for whether it's music or dance or theater or, you know, arts programs in education, much less just education as a whole, it could have really damaging effects. You know, once it's taken away, it takes decades for it to come back to the level of where it has gotten to, you know, in 2017. So it would be pretty devastating.
All right. And does it look like the prospects of that happening, or more than, because you mentioned it was raised back in the 90s, and I think it was raised under the Bush, but
yeah.
I think in the past when it was raised, Congress was pushing to eliminate it, or some of them. But we had presidents at that time that I think supported it.
Right.
So that didn't pass.
Right. It's gone up and down. You know, the funding level goes up as it does on the, certainly in the state of Missouri, you know, it goes up and then it plummets and then it goes back up depending on the governor. So I really think, you know, there's about, 1,000 things that are potentially going to happen on a government level in the next, possibly 5 days, much less 5 months. And it's really difficult to tell what will be followed through. You know, that, will the arts funding be cut? Will we go to war? You know, I mean, it's just really, you know, hard to tell who and what the players are going to be. So, I mean, my feeling is that nobody will allow this to happen. I mean, that there are so many other people that will have a say and a vote that this will not happen, you know, just like to eliminate it. Whether the funding gets cut, the funding will get cut and we'll survive and we'll find a way to survive. But the hope is that there are more people that have a say and a vote than just one person.
All right. And Unicorn, I've heard it described as equity theater.
Right.
What? Tell us, what this term equity
Sure.
Theater mean?
Equity really just refers to Actors Equity Association, which is the professional union of actors and stage managers. So, yeah, I mean, we can be certainly called, you know, an equity theater because we are a member of, we employ members of Actors Equity. Yeah. And I would say it tends to be about 75 to 80% of our actors are usually members of the union. Our stage manager and assistant stage managers are union also. So, you know, that just means that you're at a certain level of professionalism where you pay not only a somewhat living wage to your artists, but you also pay health insurance and health and welfare and pension benefits. And, you know, so there's a whole package that comes along, of course, with being in any union. So we strongly stand behind the union and we try to employ as many people from the union as possible.
So the term doesn't actually have anything to do with the type of plays you do.
Nope, not at all. Uh-huh. You know, the dinner theater is an equity theater, you know, and the Coterie employs, the Children's Theater, you know, employs some Actors Equity people too. So it really just depends if the theater becomes a member and joins along with Actors Equity to employ union actors. And I think, you know, there's a level of professionalism that comes with that. Once you make sort of that career of being an artist, whether it's a designer or stage manager or actor, you want to do that for your living, and that we try to keep as many of those people in town. So we want to employ, we do 8 shows a year, and we want to employ, you know, as many people as humanly possible with some sort of wage, and we do. We hire about probably 125, 130 artists each season. And I would say about half of those people are union, because a lot of them are designers and technicians, and they do not fall into the Actors Union. That's a whole different union.
Okay. And the plays that you're doing this year, how did you select them?
Well, you know, that's a really sort of esoteric question. I look for plays 12 months a year. Every day of my life, I'm looking for the next play. Because we only do what is happening now, the contemporary plays, it's really hard to plan too far ahead, because I'm looking for what's being written right now. You know, what is ready to be developed, you know, tomorrow. So I can't really look out too far ahead. I can't open a catalog, because usually we're vying for the rights for a play way before it's published. So it's a really kind of funny business to be in. And it means that I have to read a lot, and I have to travel, and I have to see things that are maybe in workshop or being done in New York, meet playwrights and talk about what people are writing about. We get about 500 submissions a year from playwrights at the Unicorn. And we belong to the National New Play Network, which is a continuum of theaters throughout the country of about 100, and I think we're about 110, 115 theaters right now, that are all committed to doing, developing, and producing new work. And that's world premieres, new work by new playwrights. And we share a lot of resources with them, and through them, we get turned on to about another 800-900 plays each season, you know, each 10-month period. So there's a lot of looking and reading that has to go on. And I also employ a literary manager at the Unicorn who helps me sift through a lot of the plays and
that was going to be my next question, because
yeah,
that would be too many for one person to screen.
I can't screen them. They come to me after a few other people get their hands on them. We have readers that just read new manuscripts, and Allison at the Unicorn is sort of in charge of keeping her eye on the website that all of the playwrights submit their work to, and then I try to read at least 2 to 3 plays each week, just to try to keep up. with what's going on. Sometimes they're not even, you know, you can't even get a manuscript yet, and you have to read about what they're about. But I always keep a list of what I'm interested in, what's coming up, what isn't available to me right now. Every time I wait to the last day to pick our season, the last day it's going to have to go to the printer, and that's what I have to, you know, make the decision. And waiting to see what is available at that last possible moment. Because some things, if they're playing in New York, if they're doing well, if they're up for a Tony, they're just not going to be available until that is finished. Mm-hmm. So I already have three or four on the list for 2018-19 that I'm just now able to get my hands on.
So if there's something playing currently on Broadway, they won't allow other theaters to play it.
Right. I have to sort of put my hat in the ring and, you know, write to them, well, not weekly, but we'll say every other week and remind them and say, hey, how's it doing? Is it almost available? Uh-huh. When do you think it will be available? But I have really great relationships with the publishers in New York, and so just, you know, constantly harass them about when I might be able to get certain titles that we're really looking for. I go to New York and see plays several times a year because sometimes that's the first time you're going to be able to, you know, see what a play is about. So it's really exciting. It's just, it's a little nerve-wracking because you're just always sitting on the edge just waiting for the next great thing.
And I know you do the play readings.
Right.
Each year.
Right.
How many of those typically then become full shows that you take
at the
on?
Unicorn, typically about one play will come out of our readings. We read from between four and six plays a season, and those are just brand new plays that get submitted to us by the playwrights or the agents. A lot of the playwrights we have relationships with, a lot of them are brand new, and we create a relationship with them. And anything that looks like it could be potential, you know, potentially interesting, that has something to it, you know, some meat and some interesting, wonderful subject matter. You know, I don't even often think, oh, could we cast it, because we'll find a way to cast it, you know, as long as it's probably under about 15 characters, 15 actors. And then we do a reading, and sometimes it's the first time that you actually have professional actors reading the work of this playwright. It's all been, you know, in their living room, it's been in their head. And of course, theater is created to be said out loud. It's not really written, you know, as a novel that you sit in your living room and read it. You must hear it out loud. So it's a really kind of a different art form.
And when you select a play, not from the play readings,
yeah,
but like
just in general.
In general, you're casting after you select the play?
Yeah. Usually, I don't want that to be a detriment, because very often people will say, oh, you can't cast that play, or, you know, people will not choose a play because of maybe the diversity of race or culture or gender, or, you know, there's so many reasons why people choose a play. It's like, we have more male actors than female, we have singers, we don't have, Asian actors, whatever it's going to be, that people have reasons that they choose. I don't want that to be a reason that I choose a play. In fact, if the more diverse, the better, and I will find a way to find the actors.
Well, has there ever been, in the 39 years you've been doing this, has there ever been a time when you picked a play and then you had difficulty and you weren't able to cast it?
I've had difficulty many, many times. Some plays take 10 months for me to cast. Some plays I can cast without even having a callback audition, just from the people that come in to audition for us once a year, or the actors we've used before, or the actors I see on stage locally in Kansas City. So sometimes I can cast that way, and sometimes, you know, I go through really potentially
but
6 to 8 months
had
of
to cancel.
Never. I will find a way to find the actors. There's so much talent in Kansas City, and sometimes you just have to look further. I mean, it's not necessarily a simple exercise, and a lot of times people just don't show up to audition. I mean, they don't come. You have one call a year for the general public to come. Well, what if somebody's out of town and they don't show? Or what if they don't hear about it and they don't, you know, show? So there have to be other ways to find actors. I try to see as much as humanly possible in town. I try to talk to people who may know other actors in town that I don't know. But so far, I've been able to cast every show and never put off a show because it's been too difficult to cast. I love the challenge. Give me a challenge. Sometimes I don't know how to do the set. It's like, oh, how can we possibly put this on? How can we possibly find a set that will work? It's like, okay, then let's do it so that I can get with my people around a table and all my brilliant, wonderful designers, and we find a way to do things that we've never done before. That I love. I love a challenge.
And when we were talking about the Equity Actors before, mm-hmm. I know you also use some students from UMKC.
Right.
Are you continuing that this season?
Absolutely. In fact, the last few years we've done one co-production with UMKC, and this year we're doing two. It is one of the most phenomenal experiences, really, that I have in the theater, to be able to work alongside the graduate program, the MFA program at UMKC, and work with Ted Sweats and Tom Mardikes and the incredible people over there, and be able to utilize the graduate students, the designers, the technicians, the actors, and have them work alongside us and our professional staff and commingle and put on almost the kind of show that you could never put on by yourself. No one company. It's like when we've done co-productions with KCAT sometimes. I mean, when you pool those kind of resources and put them together, you can really elevate what you're able to do. Just you have more resources, more people, more opinions, younger opinions, you know, student opinions. And so it's so great for us. It's so exciting. And it's phenomenal for them because they get to then work in a professional setting and have that on their resume. And it's really, I would say, many more times than not, a phenomenal experience.
Does Unicorn offer any workshops for students?
We do not have educational programs in that way. What we do have at the Unicorn are internships where we use either graduating seniors in high school, undergrads, graduate students, or postgraduate work. And they come into the theater and they can work in a variety of ways. We have, this summer we had three or four literary interns that were working with our literary manager and dramaturg. We have marketing interns, development, fundraising interns. We have set design interns, lighting. I mean, they're just all, anything that we do as a business or as a theater in the creative way, we have interns for. And we end up with about 40 interns per year. And that's incredible because, again, it's so fun for us to go through that process and find, you know, the right kind of fit, the right kind of person that's going to fit at the Unicorn and what we can offer them. And it's great for us because we get that, you know, that new blood and those new minds and, you know, different ideas and social media and get them in the theater. And then it's really pretty incredible for them. Also, of course, because they're, if they want to learn how to run a business or learn how to run a theater or learn how a set design is created from, you know, the first pencil drawing to the building of it to the finished painting of it, they can learn that with us at the Unicorn.
Okay. And you mentioned you have other people that help you screen these. Are these volunteers or are they people who work at Unicorn that screen with you?
There are several staff positions that helps screen the final plays with mm-hmm. me. Allison, I work with, you know, of course, that she'll read everything that we're interested in. And it was very fun this summer with our interns, our literary interns. I was having them read, you know, everything that I could get my hands on. And so they were able to sort of read these brand new plays that, you know, nobody else is going to be able to read probably for another year. And then we do have readers for each manuscript that comes in. Every single manuscript really is read by at least two readers, and those are all volunteers. Some of them are students, the graduate students taught by Felicia Landre in her dramaturge and history classes at UMKC. So we try to get people who know how to read plays, because it's not actually an easy thing to do. Most people, I don't think, most, as I call them, muggles, most lay people, can't really sit down and necessarily read a play and be able to visualize, because it's not written that way. It's not written as a novel in a descriptive, expository way that will fill in the blanks for you. You really sort of have to be able to use your imagination quite a lot. So you need people who are able to do that.
And you mentioned the term dramaturgs and literary
managers. Yeah.
Tell us what each of those are and what's the difference.
Well, our literary manager really just sort of is the head of all new plays, new works, new manuscripts, our relationships with playwrights. We send our literary manager to conventions and conferences to keep up with what's being written and to meet playwrights and to work with other dramaturgs and literary managers. Specifically, a dramaturg we use, each production we do has a dramaturg attached to it. And that is the person that does all of the research that is needed to be done on each play. Now, our plays always have a lot of research that you have to do, usually because of the subject matter. I mean, there's going to be an issue that's connected with that play that somebody's going to need to find out about and do the research on. That it's not about necessarily my everyday life or most of our audience's, you know, everyday life. There are specific things that we have to look up, and that could be the subject matter of the play, the ethnicity of the play, the geographical location of the play. I was just thinking last season when I was doing Eclipsed, you know, which took place in Africa, you know, that we had to do so much more research of places that we don't know or don't live in, and what kind of costumes, you know, that they wear, and what's the history, what's the, you know, the last war that was, you know, that everybody was subject to. So usually we have a lot to look up and many unanswered questions that the dramaturg does all of that research and creates this huge packet of information for everybody at the first rehearsal, works with the director. You know, maybe there's a dialect that needs to be studied and learned about, you know, depending on each individual character in the play. But there's just so much to do that you really can't count on each individual spending the time to do their own research and then being able to bring that research to everybody else so that everybody's on the same level. And that's what the dramaturg keeps us all on the same level of knowledge, and you can't ever have too much knowledge.
And all of your plays, at least all the ones I've seen, deal with some kind of social
justice issue.
Even like the musicals or Christmas plays bring in some, and the comedies will have something serious.
Right. Something attached to it. It's like, I need to learn more about that or that person or why, you know, just so many issues. I can think the only other profession that could have learned more than those of us who work in the theater every day of our lives is possibly being a psychiatrist or psychologist and being able to learn all of these behaviors of people depending on what their background or what they've gone through. We have to constantly put ourselves and try to figure out what that would be like, honestly, you know, in our hearts and in our souls and in our heads, of what it would be like to grow up a certain way that we couldn't possibly ever know because that isn't the way we have lived. And we want to depict as many different types of people and places on that stage, of people that are different from ourselves. I don't want to look in the mirror and see myself on stage. I want to see, you know, I want to learn something.
All right. So we're down to about 6 minutes. So I want to go through. This will be a little bit more challenging.
Oh, no.
Tell us about the 8 plays coming up in this season.
Goodness gracious, very, very quickly. Well, we're starting rehearsal tonight for the first play of our 44th season, and it's called Men on Boats. And this play, again, great historical piece that we have needed a lot of dramaturgical help on. It's about the 10 men who discovered and mapped the Colorado River that goes through the Grand Canyon. And so this is like in the 1850s, you know, and each role is played by a woman. The woman, Jacqueline Backhouse, created this play to be played, every role to be played by a woman. So it is so phenomenally interesting to see the bravado and the machismo of these characters when they are embodied by women. Because it's not like, you know, it's not a joke, it's not a parody. Each woman is actually playing one of the men, one of the explorers. So it really brings this whole different level to what these guys are like out on the rivers, and they're shooting the rapids on stage. I mean, it was just like, how do you do this? Oh my God, this is going to be so much fun to figure out. You know, how do you go down a river in a boat on stage and then bring it up to dry land and cook your dinner at a campfire? I mean, these are just such phenomenal sort of antics that we have to figure out to put on stage. So that's our first one.
All right.
And then our second play is called Disgraced. And this is about a Pakistani man who comes to America very, very young, and he becomes this lawyer, and he becomes very integrated in society. He doesn't see himself as any sort of ethnicity or race or culture different from all of his friends at the, you know, at his law partnership. And something comes up and happens that really makes him sort of have to choose, you know, between his heritage and his ethnicity and the rest of the world. And people, of course, are looking at Muslims in a very, very different way in our contemporary society, which is most of the time really unjust and unfair. And this is what happens to him. And so it's like, you know, how does he choose, and how does he sort of live his life with, you know, one foot into where he came from and one foot into the New York melting pot of everybody just being the same? And, you know, just it goes to some tough places.
Okay.
Tough places, and it's a phenomenal look, you know, at an issue that we really, really need to be careful about.
Right, so now the third play, we can't say the middle part of the name.
Oh, yeah, stupid effing bird. I know. This is such a wonderful sort of takeoff. It's a contemporary rewriting of The Seagull. So hence the stupid effing bird name. And it's fantastic. It uses the same characters, many of the same characters that are in the original Seagull, but it's a contemporary look at those characters and those artists that are all trying to be artists and have relationships. So, right, it's taking Chekhov and sort of turning it on its ear. So that's going to be really fun. And that's also a co-production with UMKC.
Okay.
And that's our holiday show. That's what you get for the holiday. And at the same time, almost at the same time, like running on its heels, will be Chesapeake, a play by Lee Blessing, which is very cool. It's sort of politics meet dogs. And, you know, what could be more fun for me is having a play about politics and dogs, about an artist, and he's getting a grant from the NEA. And this politician who wants his funding cut because he wants to censor him and thinks he's just, you know, he's doing things that should not be funded with public money. Mm-hmm. And so he gets very angry and ends up in an accident and being reincarnated as the far right politician's Chesapeake Bay retriever. And so he must learn to live with this man. And it's really hilarious, and all of a sudden takes on completely new meaning in our year here, 2017, with our new administration. Then, Jesus, do I even have time for the rest
of
our
time,
plays?
I think, one more, and then we can just name the other
I'll
ones.
Just name them, you bet. So after that, actually, is our world premiere, Project Dawn, which is a fantastic play that's actually written about a real project that was created in Philadelphia for women who had been arrested multiple times for prostitution, and the court created a program where they went through this sort of home living together where you get out of drugs and try to clean up your act, and if you do, then you would not be put in prison. And so all of these women attempt to do this, and some do very well, some do not do very well. It's a really fabulous study. Then after that is Informed Consent, about a geneticist, a woman who does research, scientific research, in trying to find, she wants to find the cure for Alzheimer's, and finds this Native American tribe that wants to find a cure. They're all dying of diabetes, and she tries to take their tribe and put her own study on it for the sake of, you know, scientific research. So when is that okay? When is it not? When do you have to take an individual's informed consent to be able to use their blood for a certain study, even if it's for the betterment of mankind? So the ethical questions are fantastic in this. And after that is Viet Gone, which I'm very excited about. It's one of the plays I'll be directing, about a Vietnamese family during the Vietnam War, who emigrate to America, and what that's like for them. They live in a camp, they're put in a camp, and then the two young boys leave the camp and go across country on their motorcycle. But seeing that whole Vietnam era through the eyes of this Vietnamese family, and it's actually really a love story to this one couple who are trying to bring their children up during this time. Really, really cool play. And to end the season is a play called Here, which is about a transgender son in a family that returns from the Iraqi war. I mean, it's really, it's a wonderful play. If I can say one subject that is being written now, in 2017, are plays that deal with transgender issues. This is so great. I have been looking for plays that can teach us a little bit more about this. And this play will not only do that, but it's hilarious and bizarrely funny in its wish to try to show you that there are no more really normal, everyday families anymore. Everybody has their own stuff connected to family and relationships, and we just have to get used to it, and we must press on.
All right. You've been listening to Cynthia Levin, the artistic director from Unicorn Theater. And Cynthia, just real quick, will you give your website for people who want more information?
Yes, unicorntheater.org. And theater, of course, is spelled as it should, with an R-E at the end, not an E-R.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Craig.